Hello, everybody. Jam Rutherford here with Self-Reliant Leadership. Really excited about our show today. I've got Christoph Morin, PhD, coming on. And Christoph has a PhD in psychology and an MBA, and he wrote a book called The Persuasion Code. Many of his books have been translated into multiple languages, and he's sold over 250,000 copies. And today he's going to talk about his brand new book, which is called The Serenity Code. And it's how brain plasticity helps you live without stress, anxiety, and depression. And you know, the thing, I was able to meet Christoph about 12 years ago. And what fascinated me about him then, as it does now, is his expertise and how persuasiveness affects our brain. So let me go ahead and bring Christoph on. Christoph, welcome. Glad to have you with us.
Welcome. Thank you for inviting me. Delighted.
Yeah. Is there anything I should have covered in that very brief bio that I did that you'd like people to know about you and your work or your
other than I'm a brain nerd and fell in love with neuroscience and want the general public to fully understand the potential that we all have to change our brain.
Yeah. And I guess on the personal side, we can all be jealous because you're on the island of Oahu as we speak.
I know.
So you don't know what fall, you don't know what autumn really is right anymore.
I do not. That's true. It's a privilege. It's an honor and a source of inspiration, certainly when you write a book and you see the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah. It takes me 2 hours to get to the Pacific from where I sit. I'm going to jump in right away because we're talking about a pretty serious topic here. And so, and hopefully we'll have some fun with it. But I want to go to something deeply personal right away. And that is October 5th, 2018. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right. Ayahuasca?
Ayahuasca. Mm-hmm.
Ayahuasca. So tell us about that experience you had that really, you know, caused this to happen.
So since I was 50, I had finally opened myself to the possibility that there would be benefit in some sort of spiritual practice. And I was extremely, as a scientist, extremely suspicious and resistant to any kind of spiritual practice. But because I'm a neuroscientist, I had an interest in the effect of some of the plant medicine that have been used spiritually for thousands of years, and decided to experience that particular plant called ayahuasca. And it was frightening, and it was a strange experience at first. But, you know, fast forward to this date in 2018, where I finally had this amazing breakthrough, you could say a spiritual breakthrough, around my core challenge my entire life, which is anxiety, and how much of my anxiety especially was, I don't want to say caused, but certainly produced by my worries for my son, who has Tourette syndrome, and this is a difficult condition to live with. And through his life stages, I just felt completely lost because I couldn't find, you know, a pill or a psychiatrist or a program that would fix him. And, you know, our rational brain is very much about, as a parent, how can we, you know, abandon our kids in this level of suffering? And that particular date woke me up to the possibility that I was also part of that equation. In other words, my own behavior, my own worries, my own, you know, incapacity of letting go and giving him full accountability was making him also anxious. And so I was really commanded, in a way, awakened to the urgency of really exploring the neuroscience of anxiety, and especially, which is a message I had never received in my entire career as a researcher, experiencing the benefit of what is called self-love or self-compassion and neuroplasticity. In other words, the message was, you know, there is no such thing as the perfect miracle cure in these kinds of conditions, because so much of these conditions are self-inflicted. And so if you don't stop at the source, the nature of how you respond to anxiety, the pill or the program or whatever is just never going to show up, right? So I had this really profound experience of waking up to the possibility that I could rewire my anxiety. And by doing so, I could most likely, and that's my hope, certainly, help, you know, thousands of people in the process.
What did it feel like when you took this? I mean,
It's well known to be sometimes pleasant and sometimes not pleasant at all. The purpose is definitely not, as you would imagine, to be recreational. All the sessions are typically conducted with shamans and songs, and there's a protocol that is, again, you know, ancient and highly respected among certain tribes. So there's potentially a lot of sickness involved, but that sickness, whether it's purging or getting sick, in other areas, is really meant to clean. There's a cleansing aspect. And then, of course, we know now, neurobiologically speaking, that you're effectively getting excessive serotonin to your brain, and the flooding of that excess serotonin is known to put you in a state that can make it much easier to examine without judgment your patterns, your coping mechanisms. The part, of course, about human psyche that is so difficult is we're constantly judging ourselves and filtering ourselves. And sometimes we're very hard on ourselves. And if you can't just let go of this naturally, well, through psychedelics, but other methods like meditation or prayer, you can finally cut off that judgment. And from open up to different interpretation.
As you describe it, and visually, I mean, I almost see it like there's a whole bunch of roadblocks. Yeah. And you're opening up things. Again, those are all self-imposed. And you're opening that up for that flood of serotonin, which is, I guess, not an exaggeration to say that would lead to some degree of enlightenment,
insight,
right?
That's right. Okay. There's a favorite author of mine, and I would encourage anyone listening to the show to check his books out, called Andrew Newberg. And Andrew is a neuroscientist and really wanted to explore the effect of these altered states of consciousness, and particularly meditation and prayer. And he put people in functional MRI, and he started to observe once they induced themselves into this state of either meditation or prayer. He wanted to see what was going on in certain parts of the brain. And he did find this, a push of serotonin. And also he found that certain areas in the brain that are typically responsible for anchoring ourselves, like in a space, making sure we know who we are, we know where we are, those areas in the brain were shut down because of the state of meditation, prayer. And that's the same thing that happens with many psychedelics, not just ayahuasca, but MDMA or even LSD. Yeah. And you find yourself, with a brand new mind to some extent, which doesn't obsess about you and your ego and your place and your urgency of, defending yourself from the environment. All of a sudden, none of those, preoccupations seems to exist. Mm. And that gives the possibility of higher states of consciousness. So, the term consciousness can be used, in all kinds of direction. But in my case, I realized for the first time in my life that I had this access, this amazing power within myself to truly believe that I could do something that doesn't involve the pill or, seeing a therapist.
Right.
Which I'm not against. But I truly believe today, with the magnitude of the problem and the rise, which is unprecedented, of stress and anxiety worldwide, we have to find and disseminate solutions that do not require, the complex process of, prescriptions and seeing mental health people is not always easy or possible. And therefore, I'm hoping that the book will contribute to the popularization of these ideas, which are, again, well documented. I certainly don't claim that the whole book is based on my ideas, not at all. It's just a consolidation of knowledge that we now know is serious about our ability to use brain plasticity and rewire our capacity to experience more serenity.
Yeah, a lot of what you're speaking about reminds me of a book by Ryan Holiday, you know, Stillness is the Key. He talks about a lot of these. And we just got a comment here. I'll put it, throw it up on the screen from Victor on yes. DMT and ayahuasca. I really recommend DMT, the spirit molecule. It's pretty well known.
It's a fabulous, well-known book. And there are many now. And of course, research is possible and legal in countries like Brazil and others. Of course, here in the United States, these substances are still considered, you know, not legal. And at the same time, there's been an opening, generally speaking, of research yeah. on psilocybin and you know magic mushrooms and LSD and especially in big trauma situations, which you know you're a vet, so you understand the seriousness of these types of mental disorders. There's very very encouraging research showing that under these kinds of substances, all controlled. I mean, we're not talking recreational mm-hmm. here. Controlled yeah. and delivered, you know, responsibly and all that. Vets are able to address, you know, trauma issues, which they just never were able to. You have end of life issues also addressed by these substances. So we're finally, I think, as a species, waking up to the potential of how they can help us feel better.
Yeah. And you, in your book, you talk a little bit about why self-help formats fail at the very beginning. Can you discuss that a little bit? Just why you think this is different than a lot of other formats?
Yes. So in the book, of course, I talk a lot about the division in our brain of mm-hmm. of labor, so to speak, between two areas. One is called the rational, which is the newest part, you know, where we think we can make decisions and so on. And the primal is the brain that we've had, you know, for millions of years that takes care of our survival, that takes care of monitoring our breathing, digestion, and so forth. And so in the book, I want to teach people how difficult it is to manage the dominance of the primal brain. And what's difficult for a self-help book is typically it's immediately tapping into the rational brain. It's saying, you should know better. These are simple, you know, techniques that you should be using. So it's coming at it from a top-down perspective. It's like you know, you can bring the energy into your rational brain. The problem with that is it's extremely difficult, especially when you're depressed or stressed, to access your rational energy. Because by definition, you're already, whether you recognize it or not, you're already hijacked by the primal brain. So you mm-hmm. have to basically gently, you know, untie that primal brain. And what I do in the book is I tell people, you can do that without just reading or thinking, by watching a video of people playing with their pets, by mm-hmm. walking for, you know, 30 minutes outside. These are ways to actually calm down your nervous system, and yeah. it's well documented. And once you have, you know, restored in a way some clarity, once you have recruited some of that energy from the rational brain, then the commitment to change kicks in. But the bigger idea, and that's what I discovered in that session in Huasca, is the concept of self-love. I never realized that love, of course, we think is some, you know, energy or gift that we have to share with others. But it's rare that we actually think of it as nurturing ourselves. And what I discovered is the same benefit that we have when we love someone, you know, it's an excessive dopamine and epinephrine, which is a very powerful neurotransmitters. But we can actually use that fuel to direct love to ourselves means that we can motivate ourselves. So it's kind of that self-help motivation we need. And it can come from simply certain, you know, habits that close the circle of how self-motivated you become. So, know, in self-help books, the big assumption is you have the power to you know, heal yourself. But the motivation is often an aspect in the book that's just not addressed. So you said to me earlier, I'm a persuasion expert. Well, I wanted to use my expertise in persuasion to actually apply it to ourselves. How do we persuade ourselves to change? That's the key.
Yeah. I wanted to, in the book, you've got a really great chart here, and you cover the six primal urgencies. Yeah, there you go. Can you talk about those six primal urgencies?
Yes.
Kind of, and it seems like that would be a good baseline to establish.
That's right. And by the way, if some of you are intrigued by this, it is in the book, but it's also downloadable for free from the website, theserenitycode.com. So the primal brain is this layer, also sometimes referred to as system one. If you have ever heard of Daniel Kahneman and this amazing book called Thinking Fast and Slow, you may have heard of system one and system two. Referencing this. Well, system one is basically the primal brain, the first part of the brain that emerged, and system two is the most evolved part of the brain. And system one, the primal brain, has biases. In other words, hardwired rules that are part of our DNA and are hardly possible to basically alter. And those six primal urgencies are really important to understand because you can catch them using your rational brain to, you know, wake yourself up to the dominance and especially the subconscious influence of the primal brain. The first one, and it's pretty obvious, the primal brain wants to protect yourself at all costs. So we are always in the primal brain vigilant. We're on a mission, in fact, to pay more attention to negative events. And so the primal brain, by design, has to amplify a threat. The problem is we tend to see in a piece of news on CNN, you know, as a threat. And the multiplication of real threats, fake threats, you know, pretend threats, virtual threat is just impossible to sort out by the primal brain. So you have this bias that is critical, called defending us, if you will. The second aspect of the primal brain, it's another urgency, is to make a decision quickly. We don't have the patience in our rational. We just want to act, you know. So we have a short-term bias, which makes us make sometimes very stupid, very silly decisions, and we hardly have any, you know, control or cognition put into that. The third aspect is we want to conserve energy. And that's, of course, related to why we decide so quickly. But we do not want to recruit, and we cannot, the best of our thinking. So in the primal brain, we don't compute. Numbers don't affect us. In the primal brain, we don't even think of the future. The future doesn't exist. We just want to be done with it with a minimum amount of cognitive effort, right? In the fourth, you know, primal urgency, is the primal brain has zero, you know, goal of memorizing anything. It's typically only memorizing what is amplified by emotion. So information, if you give me a lot of information, 99% of it is just completely forgotten. And therefore, you have to, whenever you want to influence the primal brain, you have to package and serve that message in ways that make it easy to remember, with emotion and repetition. As you know, sadly, information that's repeated, fake news, for instance, even if it's false, tends to be both believed and remembered. That's because the primal brain is already pre-wired to accept that kind of information. It's easy to chew on and it's easy to remember. The last two are important because that's how we shape our responses, and we don't always remember that. We are visual, you know, response machines. By definition, the primal brain is completely controlled by the visual system. And, you know, eyes, and this is important to note, eyes predate the existence of our cortex. So we had eyes before we had the capacity to think and, you know, sort out information. So visual impact is key. And that's why most books, unfortunately, as you know, don't have pictures, and therefore they don't have much visual impact. They force people to use their rational brain. And that doesn't deliver the message, you know, as it should. And the last piece, and this is such an important aspect, is the primal brain responds to an emotional cocktail. And so, unfortunately, we tend to be triggered when we have experience of fear or joy. And those moments, in a way, trigger even more response from the primal brain. Now, the six that I described represent, however, a language that you can learn to manipulate, and it should help you, and I've seen this now, it should help you also find strategies to lower that dominance and to lower the bottom-up effect.
And it's really fascinating. And, you know, one of the things, you know, as you look at these urgencies, one of the things that you do is you start to decode different things. But before we get into, you know, some of those things, and again, as I prepared for this discussion today, I was like, there's so many places that we could go. But what's interesting, you know, here, this book just came out, and you've got data in here from June 2020 about, you know, what we're experiencing, at least, you know, right here, stress in America, the future of our nation, government response to coronavirus, disrupted routines, getting the virus, the long-term impacts, food, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, all these yep. different things that you point out. And then what you go on to do is really kind of talk about, you know, what to remember about stress, anxiety, and depression. And, you know, you're basically, it'll affect nearly 30% of all people worldwide. I'm guessing it's higher than that these days. I mean, what other baseline is helpful to know about kind of our current state, and to take a step back? Because, you know, lately it's been sort of, there's been a lot of talk, it's okay not to be okay. Because most of us are continuing to base, anyone asks how we're doing, you know, that the automatic response is, great, I'm doing good. Everything's good. Weather's nice. I mean, we're almost programmed to be positive, even though that might not be truthful. So where are we at as let's just start right, you know, within this country, where are we at in America with all these things?
Well, those numbers, as you suggest, you know, back in June, were already pretty high. Data, you know, as recent as a week, puts the level of anxiety that is deemed excessive to 35, nearly 40%. These numbers are just like unbelievable. They've never, you know, been monitored at that level. And yes, we talk about, you know, the physical direct consequence of getting the virus, but we forget that there will be, and already is obvious, a massive tsunami of mental health issues that comes with isolation, that comes with the daily sense of dread, for not knowing what's going on, for not understanding, you know, what's going on, and making that primal brain the ruler of your behavior. And for that primal brain, every day is a day where you need to consider your survival. You know, a lot of psychological studies have come out and said, why are people not making decisions? You cannot make long-term decisions when you're under the dominance of your primal brain. The future does not exist for the primal brain, and it has nothing to do with your intelligence, has nothing to do with your capacity ultimately to kind of come back. It's because the primal brain is just so over activated, it compromises, you know, our ability to restore a sense of normalcy. Now, this might be shifting now, to the extent that we have been, you know, 7 or 8 months now into this situation. So to some extent, mm-hmm. we go, well, we kind of know what has been the situation for 6 or 7 months. So maybe that's all we need to do, which is to adapt and consider that as the new normal and so on. So I already see, psychologically speaking, that some of that grip of the primal is being relaxed. But the truth is, to fully experience serenity, I think we have to learn more about ourselves. So that's part of the book, you know, learn about your dynamic relationship between that primal self, the rational self. And of course, I throw in the whole idea of the bonus, you know, of a spiritual self. So mm-hmm. understanding yourself is the first step, and taking a deep dive into your personality, that's helpful. And then really making the conscious, you know, decision, I want to love myself. And that's not narcissism. That's a different energy where you just recognize that you're, you know, a little judgmental and hard on yourself. What if I love myself? And what if I craft, third step, new habits that are giving me this kind of free flow neurotransmitter, serotonin? Yeah, I got it. You know, dopamine, you know, and so I've identified seven very basic habits which you can engage on a daily basis, and they're going to bring you enormous, feel good chemicals that that will then participate in rewiring to some extent the treatment of stress and anxiety. This is what most people don't quite fully understand. We have been given software to protect ourselves from threats. And so part of that stress, part of that anxiety is completely normal. It should happen. And so we have to learn for each of us what is the part that I can deal with and the part that's just not on, you know, that's not good. And once you have that understanding, it becomes more of a balancing act between the different parts of your brain.
It's interesting. I mean, so you kind of went through decoding, you know, what you call in your book, decoding the self, yep. And then decoding habits. It's interesting, as an executive coach, there's times when I'll see their self-blame is sky high. Yep. And one of the last things I'll say to somebody that's just kind of beating themselves up is I'll say, you know, hey, Christoph, do me a favor, you know, be nice to that person in the mirror. Be nice to that guy. He's a good guy. And when I say that to people sometimes that are, you know, having a rough day, it's almost, they almost break down because they realize that they're being brutal on themselves. So as you look at these habits, you said there's seven. I mean, are there a couple that would be good to highlight for those that are listening?
Yes. And in fact, since there are seven, I can go really quick at it. The first three I want to talk about are specifically known to quiet the primal brain. And the reason they do is because they ground you into a safe present. So the first one is simply connecting with nature. And there's huge amount of evidence of the benefit of a walk, particularly in the forest. In Japan, they've made it almost like a religion, just to walk in nature and around trees. And the benefits are profound. The second one is one that I certainly, in a way, I had experienced because I've always, you know, loved having pets around, but I never fully understood the neurochemical effect of being with pets. And this piece of research that I present in the book is really incredible. And there's more and more documentation on the benefit of pets and their, and not just as companions, but as beings that can restore more serenity, particularly older population and so on. And I've changed my behavior. You know, I have three cats. I now make it a mindful exercise of playing with my cats every day and watching them. And there's so much peace and serenity that comes just from that. It's absolutely amazing. The third one is, of course, again, also well documented. It's the power of breath. And we forget, and in fact, we are, because we're so busy and so stressed, a poor breather. And so there is really good research on how to use breath, of course, to restore, you know, tough moments of panic and anxiety, but also as a practice. Breathing, of course, is central to meditative states, but yoga and other forms. I talk about an accelerated breathing techniques called holotropic breathwork, which is in fact developed by one of the most brilliant psychiatrists of all time, Stan Grof, and his research on LSD, proved to him that there was some value into that state, but realized, I can't really, you know, ask people to take LSD. So he came up with this method of accelerated breathwork, which puts people into this almost LSD-like, altered states of consciousness. So those three are easy yet. If you don't make it a practice, and I call it a ritual, so something that's deeply anchored in your, you know, in your routine, it's not going to serve much benefits. The second set is more of a rational engagement that we need to, in a way, stimulate our rational brain. Laughter is huge, and it's amazing to me how just watching something that's funny or just engaging in playfulness and so on, how healing it is. It's just mind-boggling. Connecting with music, of course, lots of research and the way music is, in fact, used in hospitals and clinically. And so I truly believe that we should all have a practice of listening to music every single day, just for that purpose. And stories. I mean, stories, you know, have been by far the best format for humans to share, to learn. And good stories, feel-good stories, are especially very powerful to our brain to make us feel, you know, settled. And that's why we watch movies. And that's why, by and large, we hate movies that don't end well. Haven't you noticed? And the last one, which is kind of the big, you know, opportunity in terms of modalities, is that connecting with spirit. And again, not to make it in any kind of way connected to any form of organized religion, the idea of kind of transcending to this high level of consciousness.
Going back to the laughter, somebody had to have talked about the Seinfeld episodes with Serenity Now, right? Serenity Now. Are you familiar with that, Christoph?
I am not. Remember, I was born in France, and even though I've been here for a while, there's still references that sometimes escape me. Is that one of those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So you know about the show Seinfeld, Jerry Seinfeld.
Of course, yes.
There was a whole thing that when George's father would get upset, you know, his psychiatrist told him to yell Serenity Now. And he didn't go Serenity Now like this. He'd go Serenity Now. And, and you know, it was basically he had a high state of agitation. But as you get this word out, there's going to be people that I'm sure, you know, mention this and they get a big kick out of it. But I would encourage you to go look it up on YouTube.
Okay.
But the other habit you talked about, and this comes up a lot these days because a lot of people are all trying to help people, especially leaders, be better storytellers. So, you know, mm-hmm. you talk about connecting with stories. And I know from your work, you know, that I've experienced, I mean, you talk about how powerful stories are, you know, because of the beginning, the middle, the end. What are the things, you know, on a daily basis that you can tell us a little bit more on that habit?
Well, it's interesting you highlight this particular one, and what's pretty remarkable in terms of stories is you can be the director, you can be the actor, or you can be the spectator. So what's really fabulous about story is how it can engage so many areas of our brain. For instance, when we watch a movie, it turns out that, especially if it's a motion picture, our visual attention, 80% of it goes to the character's facial expression. So, you know, when we absorb a story, most of that experience is about our fascination for how are people feeling in that story. Are they stressed? Are they happy? And so on. And you may have heard, and I talk about it in the book, about mirror neurons. These are very special neurons that were discovered, you know, 3 decades ago mm-hmm. by Italian neuroscientists. And these neurons are able to duplicate or mirror, which is why, of course, they're called that, others either behavior, like motor behavior, or feelings. So we have the software in our mind for immediately soaking and getting signals of characters in different stories, which makes us learn, of course, very, very fast. And we learn a lot, much more than we think. We learn a lot by just observing and mimicking and replicating what we see. And so the benefit of watching stories is doing that, is feeding, you know, your brain's desire to learn about characters and so on. But you can also write and direct your story. And by doing that, it becomes more of a creative exercise. It becomes an opportunity to be with yourself and your mind and so on. So yes, you're right. I'm fascinated by the power of stories, and stories have been, you know, around for thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, and they're here to stay. And we need to learn, certainly as leaders, we need to understand the power of stories on others and the power of crafting and delivering stories, for sure.
Mm. You know, so much of what you talk about reminds me of what happens on the wilderness expeditions that I lead called Crucibles. And again, the big takeaway always is the same thing. You've got to slow down to speed up. And that, you know, we call it a digital detox, you know, that people get out there and they slow down, they figure out what's important. A lot of what you're saying, you know, again, you use the word serenity. But, you know, what's interesting is when people get out there, they know they need to do this. They know they need to slow down. But a lot of them don't realize how stressed out they are until they get out there and stop. So, you know, again, with the pandemic going on, I think most people know they're stressed out. They're anxious. You know, there's bouts of depression. So I think that might be different than it was a year ago, that we know that. But, you know, again, I think a lot of Americans might be uncomfortable with that whole term of self-love. There's all kinds of connotations there. You know, I wonder if there's, you know, a different phrase that you might use that people, you know, say, hey, if you don't take care of yourself, this is going to lead to all kinds. I mean, if you're saying we can rewire our brains for more serenity, and that'll lead to better mental, emotional, and physical health, how do we get people to even, you know, basically take the first step?
Yes. Well, again, the first step is awareness. The first step is to understand whether or not you're anxious or stressed. You're right. Most people would say, yeah, I'm anxious or stressed. But to understand where is that affecting, you know, the coping mechanisms? What are some of the patterns that you may not be aware are happening below the, you know, below the surface? So awareness is key. The second is to really accept this very simple idea, now well documented, that you need to direct some of that attention on yourself. And if self-love is not the right way to call it, self-compassion is definitely a term that is more academically used to describe what I'm talking about. In positive psychology, you know, self-compassion is a big deal. Self-care, self-liking. And yes, you're right. I mean, in fact, I talk about the history of self-love as being, you know, very contentious. And in fact, you know, religiously, the whole idea was very highly criticized. Yeah. And it's about time we wake up to this idea that how can we not, you know, nurture ourselves? So it's more this idea of nurturing, of being in tune with ourselves, and recognize that so much of our growth and our serenity is not gonna, you know, happen on its own. It has to come from a different relationship with ourselves. And I get it. I get that many people are not comfortable with that. In fact, culturally, you could say, since, you know, I'm French and I've traveled all over the world, I would say Americans are sometimes much harder on themselves, you know, that I see in other countries, because the idea of success is I'm strong, I'm going to make it, and you know, I don't need to take care of myself as much. So there's this almost a stigma around this idea of self-compassion. Would you agree?
I would. And I think, you know, the whole idea of the mirror neurons, I think, is important, because if somebody says, hey, I'm not going to do it for myself, I one of the things that resonates with young people when it comes to leadership is the whole idea of, hey, a big part of leadership is managing the energy of those around you. Yeah. And in order to do that, you have to manage your own energy. You know, you can't lead other people on an empty tank. And I think, you know, anyone that's been in sales knows that what you put out is what you get back. You know, if you're positive and confident, you know, things are going to go better than if you're having a crappy day. You're going to feel like everybody's crappy to you. And I just wonder, if that's a little bit of the trigger that would make people do that, is to really understand that hey, you have an obligation, a duty for those around you that you care about, those you love, to put your best self out there.
Yes,
you know, I love it.
That's a great reframe. In other words, you know, and you could add, as a leader, you become the object of observation. You will influence through the mirror neurons of your, you know, of your tribe. You will influence the way they feel. And if you inside feel anxious or have self-worth issues, that energy, that part of you is going to be picked up. But if you exude, you know, centeredness, groundness, confidence, calm, composure, that's contagious.
Yeah. Well, so much of, you know, I've got two mastermind groups that I work with. One is senior executives and one is all veterans that are now out of the service. And in both groups, a big thing that comes up is, you know, balance and boundaries. And last week we had a whole discussion about boundaries and Brené Brown's work. And, you know, that if you don't do that, you're just going to, I mean, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you're just going to be taken advantage of. You know, the good horse gets worked to death, that we take on, you know, we take on more and more and more, and we don't basically put boundaries up and say, you know, this is time for self-care. You know, this is, I'm going to invest time so that I can be my best for other people. And, you know, I think I just saw a stat the other day that something about, you know, people have worked more hours in the last 7 months, that, you know, the number of hours that have been worked because people are at home is way more. And I was thinking about that today. I was driving to get my annual physical, and I can't even remember the last time I, you know, was out driving in the middle of the, you know, the morning. And I'm like, God, this is a whole new world that I haven't seen, because I'm most of the time in this office working.
Right.
And I'm really, I think I'm pretty good about getting out on bike rides and hikes and walks and things, but it's become routine. And I think part of it is looking at, you know, things to break routines too, to have, you know, different insights.
Yeah. Routine is really important. I talk a lot about that in the book, and the concept of habit. You know, mm-hmm. we sort of take it for granted, but there is a real science behind. In fact, there's an excellent book called Habit. But in mine, I do talk about the neuroscience of habit, and how crucial it is for our nervous system to have this sort of regular, you know, schedule of commitments that clearly bring peace and joy and consciousness. And we need it. It's really something we've lost. So a lot of what I talk about, I think, is when you look at the way indigenous or, you know, ancient civilizations were organized, and I know we can't live the way, you know, people lived 15,000 years ago, but they didn't spend, you know, 12 hours on a screen. That's what we do on average, 12 hours, right? We consume media for the most part. It's something we've been sucked into. And so what I'm suggesting is kind of bring back the wisdom, and so much of what you do in the wilderness, exercise is very much about grounding back to who we are, you know, that's animal nature, this part, you know, we are guests on the planet, you know, all these good, powerful messages about what we should do to keep it clean and safe and keep us safe as well. So, yeah.
Well, you know, I know this is, I mean, to say this is your passion, it would be a gross understatement. you know, what you're trying to do and the change you're trying to make. I remember before you got your PhD, you know, you were so passionate, and you knew, you know, that there was some academic rigor that you wanted to apply to some of the things you've done. So I think what's really interesting is you're a man of science, somebody that really understands the rational part of our brain, but also the primal part. I mean, that's what I you know, has been a common theme in all that you've done. And I think, you know, that's just an interesting approach these days, because oftentimes we're either getting one side or the other, not somebody that's coming at it from two different. For the leaders that are listening and businesses out there, we know that mental health is a major issue that's going to affect their productivity and efficiency to come. We know that not everybody is going to produce, you know, put a certain amount of output every single day. It's just, I mean, most of us are like this right now. What is it that you've got all put together that businesses and leaders can tap into to help themselves and to help their team along with this book?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think it's important to not shy away from that often difficult conversation. And there's a lot of denial, you know, potentially that, you know, my employees are okay. So I do think that there is benefit in bringing that conversation out. And, you know, we created an assessment tool for that purpose, to give people an opportunity to benchmark themselves on, you know, and this is a super fast test you can take on our website, serenitycode.com. But it will, you know, just kind of draw that line and say, okay, what are we dealing with? And that could be really beneficial for, let's say, an executive team to kind of agree that we're going to benchmark ourselves on these concepts. And then once we learn where we are, maybe there are, you know, healthy aspects that are discussed in the book that can be regularly discussed and promoted. A lot of companies have integrated, you know, the possibility to take time off to meditate or pray, or some meetings are conducted outside. Of course, in the context of COVID, that's a little awkward. But just find ways to make this a subject of conversation. Mental health is also related to productivity. And if your team is unproductive, you can't just blame it on, you know, skills any longer. You have to recognize that the psychological health, the motivation is a central aspect of productivity. So that's what I would, you know, recommend, is just be willing to open that conversation.
Yeah. You know, we interviewed Jeffrey Pfeffer a while ago, a professor at Stanford. And I remember asking him about, you know, leadership metrics. And one of the things he said was, he said, it'd be great if you could really find out, you know, what the use of antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds are on your team. Because he's like, I'm positive there's a link between effective leadership, you know, and mental health. And we know in the McKinsey work that's come out recently, 25% of our well-being is tied to work. And as you go downstream, about 86% of that work score is related to the boss. You know, that the boss has a lot of effect on mental health. So I think it's interesting that you said that organizations could and should take a benchmark of some of these things and find out where their team is, because there's probably a little bit of a cause and effect between the work environment and culture and what people are feeling, you know, in their overall life satisfaction, if you will. So, yeah. So your website is serenitycode.com, right?
The serenitycode.com.
TheSerenityCode.com. Yeah, and that's where they can see the survey.
Yeah. Yeah. They can see there's a link called assessment. Of course, people can email me, you know, if they have questions. And the book is described. As I said, the map is there for free. I'm keen to, in fact, provide a tool that people can use to understand the concepts. If they don't want to read the book, that's fine with me. I really want to make sure I can disseminate the essence of what I teach here in just a few minutes.
Yeah. Well, I don't. I've sat in your seminars, Christoph, for 8 hours, and 8 hours wasn't enough. And I'm sure, you know. And again, what's interesting too is you basically say to the readers, "Hey, this is 3 hours to read, and yeah, about a half hour if you do some of the work. So not a huge investment.
Time
to dig through." And you know what I've always loved about your work is, you know, you really, you know, sort of practice what you preach. So there's a lot of visual aids always on your website that people can download. And to me, those really help,
yes,
you know, really reinforce. So, well, again, thank you for the work that you do in trying to help others. Thank you for being so vulnerable and open about, you know, mm-hmm. your experience and, you know, with your family.
Yep.
That takes a lot of courage.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to visit yeah. with you, Dan, and your work is profound. I know that. So we'll meet again, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, Christoph. Well, thank you again. And again, hope thank everybody you. Picks up the book, The Serenity Code.
All right.
There you go.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.